this is Wendy Wood. You're listening to the Run to the Top podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Run to the Top podcast with me, your host, Claire Bartholik, a.k.a. The Planted Runner. I would assume that most of you listening have a pretty good running habit going. Or if not, you used to have one or you are trying to establish one. But what does that really mean? You like to go run, so you go run. Or you want to lose weight and running could be a great way of doing that. But you probably think your running is a conscious choice, that you choose to run every time you lace up your running shoes. In some respects, yes, you do choose to run. But more often than not, if you've been running consistently for a long time, your running is a habit. It's just something that you do without a ton of thought about whether you will run today or not. Sure, you might be thinking about your interval workout or perhaps how on earth you're going to hydrate properly for your long run today, but the habit of running is something that you eventually don't have to think about anymore. And if you're like most runners, you've got a great running habit going, but maybe that strength training habit isn't your strong suit. Or maybe you've got a few habits that you know you'd like to get rid of, but you just can't quite seem to let them go, despite your best intentions. This is why I wanted to have psychologist Wendy Wood on the show. For the past 30 years, Wendy has been researching why we do the things we do and how habit formation, both good and bad, can shortcut the effort required to complete a behavior. Wendy is Provost Professor of Psychology and Business at the University of Southern California, and she literally has written the book on habits, appropriately called Good Habits, Bad Habits. And not to mention, she's been a longtime runner. We talk about how our intentions are no match for our habits and how repetition, time of day, and your environment all work together to reinforce both your good habits and your bad habits. Surprisingly, having a goal or a big reward for the behavior that you are doing becomes less and less important as your habit becomes more ingrained, so that you can just go do the behavior without a whole lot of mental energy or mustering up a lot of willpower. Of course, the irony in establishing a good shortcut to a good behavior is that it takes time. Time to repeat the action over and over again until you no longer think much about it. And that's why your first run is harder than your second, which is harder than your third, and so on. Until one day you realize, hey, this isn't so bad, I actually like this. And unfortunately, a new habit takes a lot longer than the magic 21-day myth that you might have heard about. Wendy and I talk about how to shortcut the establishment of your good shortcuts, how to create friction so your bad habits are less appealing, and how creating routines can even allow you to become more free and creative. This episode went a little longer than my usual time, but I just loved Wendy's book and had so much to ask her about, and I know you're going to love this one too. And now, here's Professor Wendy Wood. Welcome to the Run to the Top, Wendy.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you are a research psychologist who has devoted the last 30 years to understanding how habits work. And you're also a runner. So when I heard about your work and I read your book, Good Habits, Bad Habits, I knew I wanted to have you on the show. First off, what got you started in studying our habits?
Well, I actually started off studying people's attitudes and beliefs and how they change them. But it became really clear that we do change attitudes and beliefs pretty easily when we get new information, when our friends shift. Right now, we're all in the middle of the virus crisis, and that's changed a lot of our experiences. What doesn't change so easily, though, is our behavior. And that's what got me interested in habit. What is it that makes it's so difficult for people to change behavior and make it stick? We all have, we actually have a national institution, New Year's resolutions, sort of celebrating this change in beliefs and commitment, and we make decisions, we're going to change, and then most of us actually don't follow through. So it's a common experience that we've all had, and trying to figure out how people can change their behavior and what people are doing who are really effective at sticking with something. That's what started to fascinate me, and that's how I started to study habit.
In your book, you said intentions are no match for our habits. Can you describe this and basically define what a habit is?
Yeah. So our brains are made up of a whole set of interconnected parts. And one of those parts we're really familiar with, which is our thoughts and our feelings and our intentions, our expressed goals, what we plan to do. But there are other parts that we're not so aware of, and habits are one of those parts. Habits are a very slow learning memory system. They pick up what we do over and over again to get a reward. So you can imagine they're a pretty basic learning system. We actually share them up. Dogs have habits, rats have habits, all mammals have this sort of same learning system. And it's a learning system that picks up the most important information in our lives, which is the repeated information, right? It's what we're going to do in order to eat, what we're going to do in order to be safe, what we're going to do in order to interact with other people. We do those things repeatedly. They're very rewarding, very important. And they're captured in habit memory. So habit memory picks things up slowly, and it changes very slowly, which is different than our intentions. You know, I can form an intention to go running today just by talking to you. But forming a habit to go running is something very different. And you asked me to define what habits are. I think the easiest definition is that habits are mental shortcuts. They're mental shortcuts that we form. We form them as we repeat behavior. And they indicate, what should we do in this situation in order to get the kind of rewards we got in the past? So they're shortcuts for effectiveness, for what to do to be successful.
Okay, so a running habit, for example, I can use my own experience. I will tell you, the first year that I was a runner, I hated every second of it. And then eventually it became just a part of my identity, who I am. It's obviously my job now. But, you know, it took forever for it to be something that I really identified with. So is that really a common experience for most people that you found?
Yes. It's actually true. The first time we do most things is much harder than the second and the third and the fourth. A colleague of mine actually looked at how long it takes people to form a habit so that they're doing things repeatedly without thinking much about them and without having that struggle that you talk about during the first year, making yourself get up and do it. And for exercises like running, it can take 3-4 months if you're doing it regularly. We're talking every day on a regular basis in a sort of a standard routine way. So running is complicated. It's a hard behavior to learn. It has so many different parts. There's the getting ready part. There's the actual figuring out your pace, figuring out the kinds of running shoes you want to wear, your route, time of day. It's complicated. And behaviors like that take a bit longer to learn, to become a habit, than things that are really simple.
So does it take a lot less time to establish such a running habit, for example, if you take out some of those decisions? Like, for example, run at the same time every day, always have the same pair of shoes, always run the same routes. Is there a shortcut to getting that shortcut of a good habit?
Yes. Yes. Your insight, your intuition there is correct. That you can speed up the process by decreasing the decisions that you have to make and making it more standard and regular. So I have to admit, I'm not a runner anymore. I ran for 25 years and I absolutely loved it after that first year. First getting used to it. And the first year, for me at least, had a lot of sort of fits and starts. You know, I'd had great ambitions. I had just had I have two sons, and I, like many women, I experienced a weight gain, and I was very uncomfortable after they were born. I didn't like being that heavy. And so I would try all kinds of different things to get myself out running. And it took about a year of trying different things to figure out exactly what was the right approach for me. And that was some of the angst, was the trying and failing. And then sort of having to think through, okay, so what would be a better approach? And for me, it turned out to be first thing in the morning, before my sons got up. I would get up at 6 every morning, and I had a dog that loved to go running with me, and so she would remind me very actively if I didn't get up that it was time to go running. So you figure these things out over time, and once that happens, then you figure out what it is that you can standardize and make more regular, so that the automaticity, that feeling of it being fluent and easy and not a struggle, that kicks in.
Yeah, that seems to go kind of against how we're wired as far as novelty. We're talking about novelty. We crave things that are new. We want to do new and exciting things. But you're also saying that the repetition, the doing the thing over and over and over again, is also what we crave?
No, I actually don't think we crave it, which is one of the things that that makes it so difficult to do. Is, you're right, people like novelty and they like new sensations. And what happens when you form a habit is that you're essentially not experiencing that activity in the same way as you do when you do it first time.
Right.
You're doing it in the same way, so it doesn't have the same highs or the same lows for you. And particularly if you're a long distance runner. I was never very fast, but I loved to run long distances. And around that, I don't know, 8th, 9th mile, which probably doesn't sound long to some of your listeners, but
that's long. I call that long.
If you're paying a whole lot of attention to how you feel, it's not a good thing. So having a habit in that case actually does help. Now, for some of your listeners who are training and actually trying to improve, might have a goal of running a marathon or some other sort of large goal like that, they might wonder what habits will do for them. Well, what the habit does is it helps form an infrastructure so that you can use it and build on it. It doesn't necessarily limit you. And the example I always give is famous writers. They are notorious for having habits, writing habits. They write at certain times of the day. They write for certain amounts of time. And their writing isn't constrained by those habits. Instead, it's facilitated by them. They can then go off and be creative and do something different, think of new things while they are relying on their writing habit. So I have a son who is an avid cyclist. He's a very active competitor. And he has figured out that if he works out at the same time every day, that it makes it much easier for him to stick to his training schedule.
Sure.
But he doesn't do the same thing every day. Some days it's sprints. Some days it's long distance. He does different things. And the structure that he's formed around time of day allows him to do that much more easily than at least I could
right.
with that same goal. So his habits, he's formed habits that have enabled him to meet his goals, and his goals for training are continually changing. He has a coach, but the habit helps him just get on his bike trainer and actually do it.
Yeah. Well, I would love to talk about goals and how they relate to habit. You've said that when you're forming a habit at the beginning, a goal is absolutely critical. But as the habit becomes more established, you might not need the goal quite as much, or perhaps not at all. And, you know, how that relates to running, especially this year, so many of our running races, our big goals have been canceled. And some of the runners react in one way and they completely stop training or almost stop training. And other runners just seem to find brand new goals, other ways to motivate. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that and how these two groups are different.
Well, I'm not going to answer exactly that question because I don't know how those two groups are different. It is, okay. You are absolutely right that when you form a habit, goals become less important. So we actually did some research with runners and we brought them into the lab, people who run on a regular basis, as well as people who run only once in a while. And we asked them where they typically run or have ever run. And then we also asked them their goals for running. What we were interested in is, so for people who have a strong running habit, what is it that actually gets them out on the track, that makes them think of running, that makes them start? And one way to do that is to see, so what brings running to mind? Is it the goals that you have for running? And so we ask them specific goals. Are you doing this for general fitness? Are you doing this for a race? Are you doing this for some specific thing? As well as where specifically they typically run. And what we found is that for people with running habits, where you run activates thoughts of running. But goals weren't associated with thoughts of running anymore. It was as if they had done it so often that it had become, as I said, sort of it's a shortcut. It's a mental shortcut for what to do in a context that was successful in the past. It was the people who didn't run very often. For them, their goals for running brought running to mind. So for those people, it was as if they had to keep thinking of their goals in order to get them out on the track and get them running. So once you become a habitual runner, it's as if you can use that pattern in the service of a whole bunch of different goals, right? You could use it to run a race. You could use it to keep a base level of fitness until the race is open again, which they we hope they will.
Let's hope.
But that framework is like the framework that writers have. They could use it to do a lot of different things once you've formed that habit. For people who quit, maybe they didn't have as strong running habits. That's one hypothesis. Okay. Or maybe something else happened in their lives to make their old habits less easy to activate. So if you have your kids at home and you're homeschooling them, along with trying to keep your job going, or if you've lost your job and you're worried constantly about bills and other sorts of things, all of those kind of shift your focus and might make it harder to stick with old habits. So there, right. I did speculate on an answer.
No, that's good. We don't have our normal running cues because our lives have been turned upside down, or at least many of our lives have been. And so we're out of our routine. So that does make sense. One thing that I would love to get your thoughts on are, how do you establish a habit that isn't daily? Like, for example, strength training. I often tell my athletes that they should strength train, lift some weights twice a week or three times a week. And if for some people, that's a lot harder than doing it every single day. So, how do we get ourselves to do more intermittent things on a regular basis, just not on a daily basis?
Oh, you're absolutely right. For me, the big thing that I needed when I was running was yoga. Strength training is important too, but power yoga is sort of strength training plus stretching and all those other things. But if you love running, it's very hard to take a day off and say, I'm going to do something else. Mm-hmm. It takes thought, it takes effort, and then you like the running part. So it's, yes, you're right. It's a challenge. The way I ended up working through it was to form broader habits that were week long. So on Mondays and Tuesdays, I might run, but on Wednesdays, I would set up, I would try to set things up the night before. So I'd set up my yoga mat, or I'd find a friend and go to a yoga class with them after work instead of working out beforehand. I'd do something so that that day was set up differently right from the beginning, so that I wouldn't go running that day. And that then, if you practice that whole sequence, the 7-day sequence, that's an easier way to think about it than I'm an intermittent runner, strength trainer, some days. It's easier to think about it holistically and how you would structure in each of those different activities on each day.
Okay, so I like that. That's kind of telling yourself, I am a daily exerciser. Not necessarily I run every single day, but I'm going to do something every day for my fitness. And so it is a habit that is maybe different every day, but it's still the same sort of thing. Is that what you kind of mean?
Yes, although I think that in order for it to be a habit, that you really need to structure in certain days for certain activities. So that, say, Wednesday is always going to be your yoga day, and you just know that that's what you do on Wednesdays. And so you set up the mat or your friend or your class or whatever ahead of time so that you've structured it in.
Okay. Well, we've been mostly talking about good habits. We should probably talk a little bit about bad habits. You've said that they're not that different as far as the way the brain works. One study that you referenced in your book was the famous marshmallow study, which everybody has heard about, where little kids are given a marshmallow, and if they don't eat it in a certain period of time, they'll get a second marshmallow. And of course, all hilarity ensues, and these poor little kids end up eating the marshmallow in most of the occasions. Yeah. So except for some very, I don't know, resilient little kids who end up getting both. What I wanted to ask about, you talk about hiding the marshmallow, you know, hiding the temptation, getting it out of sight, out of mind. Can you talk a little bit about how we can change our bad habits?
There are many questions in there. Let me start with the bad habit. One, you're right. Bad habits are very similar to good habits. The difference between them is that bad habits are inconsistent with our goals. So a habit that's working for you right now may not work for you in 3 months or 4 months or 5 months once this virus thing has gone away, we hope. Maybe some of the habits that are working now that you've learned aren't really good ones anymore for you because they're not consistent with your goals. And then they're bad, and then you have to figure out ways to change them. And you're absolutely right that the way we thought, psychologists thought about changing behavior up until very recently has involved self-control. And that marshmallow study is the classic because watching 4-year-olds try to exert self-control is like, it's how we all feel, but so few of us are as expressive as they are when they try not to eat the marshmallow. The interesting thing in that study is all you need to do is cover up the marshmallow. So take a cake tin and put it over the marshmallow and leave the 4-year-old there. Tell them, you can lift up the cake tin and take the marshmallow anytime you want to, but if you can wait 15 minutes, you'll get 2. And then 75% of the kids can do it.
Wow.
What this demonstrates is we all have self-control. It's just self-control is much more in our environment. It's much more around us than in us. We think of self-control as self-denial and sort of white-knuckling it through difficult situations and temptations. But instead, it can be enabled by very simple shifts in our environment, like just covering up the marshmallow, making things a little easier that are good for you, and making things a little bit more difficult that you don't want to do. My favorite example of this was a study with elevators. So this was researchers in an office building trying to get people to take the stairs. And they put signs all over the elevator, take the stairs, it's good for you, good for your health, you'll work out. You'll save energy, no effect. So they thought, okay, so what can we do to get people to take the stairs? So they slowed down the elevator door closing 16 seconds.
Wow.
They slowed it 16 seconds. And they cut a third of the elevator use.
Wow.
So people just headed for the stairs. It took too long to take the elevator. And
they were just impatient.
Yes. The interesting thing is that after 3 months, when the researchers put the elevator back to its standard speed, people still took the stairs. because they'd gotten used to it. It had become their habit.
Right.
And they weren't willing to deal with this elevator again that sometimes was really slow. So they just stuck with the stairs. It's just another example of how our intentions, we all know we should take the stairs. Of course, I mean, it was a 4-story office building. It wasn't like they were going to have to climb 20 flights or anything like that. But it's an easy way to insert exercise into your day.
Right.
But people just don't do it unless we make it easy.
So hide the potato chips and park far away from the grocery store. All these things that they tell us to do, but we still have a hard time putting those chips in the cupboard instead of out on the counter. Or don't buy the chips in the first place.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I think part of it is we think, well, you know, if I want to be healthy, of course I won't eat those chips. I can leave them out on the counter. But then half an hour later, we're hungry. And life looks very different.
Yes. So now that you're a researcher and you've studied all of this about habits, does that mean you do everything perfectly in your life now that you know all this information?
That's hilarious.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because you've said that even though we know better, we don't always do better.
Yes.
So I'm hoping to give you a pass too.
You're kind. I do know, the one thing I do know is that if I don't control my environment, then I'm going to find it hard to follow through, even on intentions that mean my best intentions. So since I haven't been running, I started having back problems. And so I had to quit. And I really thought that was going to be the end of my life because I loved it so much. And it was such a hard thing to give up. But I tried out different alternatives and I found that an elliptical gives you somewhat of the same high as running, mm-hmm. but without the same stress on your joints. And I hate going to the gym. Mm-hmm. So I bought my own elliptical and I like being outside. So I make sure that it's in a room where I can open windows, open doors. And if the weather is at all reasonable, I can feel kind of like I'm outside. So having that encourages me to work out on the elliptical on a regular basis. If I made myself go to the gym, I don't think I'd be as successful. So you need to know what is going to encourage you to do the right thing. Honestly, I don't like potato chips, so you can have them on the counter as long as you want.
They don't even come in my house. I can't resist them. They're just banned. I can't have them. I have no willpower. But I'm sure there's something that is the same with you, right?
Yes. For me, it's ice cream. Fortunately, you can have that out on the counter. So
good. Good. Another great thing that I learned from your book is if you remove the friction, that is what can help you develop much better habits. So can you talk a little bit about the friction? I know that's kind of like the elevator. They introduced friction by slowing down those door closing times. But what about things in creating good habits?
Yeah, this is it's a classic construct in psychology, the idea that there are forces on our behavior that make some things easier and other things more difficult. It was Kurt Lewin and his field theory came up with this idea. And you're absolutely right. Elevator door time can be friction. Distance is also friction. There was a great study done by a data analytics firm on tracking cell phones. And all our cell phones are being tracked all the time. It tracked how far people, or actually the cell phones, went to a paid fitness center. And what they found is that if the cell phones, and obviously the people holding them, went 3.6 miles to a gym, to a paid fitness center, then they went five times a month. But if they went 5.1 miles, which is only like a mile and a half more, they only went once a month. So distance can be friction as well. If you want to get to the gym to work out on a regular basis, find one that's close to you. Find one that is easy to incorporate into your daily routine. Maybe on your way home from work, on your way to the store, something that reduces the friction, the distance, to make your workout easier. And for each of us, that's going to be something a little different. Mm-hmm. But there are some commonalities, right? Time is friction, distance is friction, and marketers know this so well. There's a saying in stores, when you go into stores, among retailers, that eye level is bi-level, meaning shoppers are going to buy what they see and identify easily. They're not going to search for better deals. Most of them aren't going to search for better deals. And online retailers know this too, that one-click ordering is part of the reason why Amazon has been so successful. Two clicks and you lose customers. You're making them work a little bit more. There's a little bit more friction. And that's enough to stop a behavior. It doesn't make sense to our conscious minds that we would be so influenced by something like this, but our behavior is very responsive. And friction is important for forming habits because you want to make it easy to repeat the behavior in the same way each time. And you're not going to do it if you have to work.
Right. Yeah. If you have to stop and think, you're likely to make the bad decision, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So we need to take our thinking brains out of the picture. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Or use our thinking brains to recognize that our behavior is not going to be driven by what we think it is. It is controlled by what goes on in our environment that we think shouldn't be that important.
It's really fascinating. I loved your book. I think I learned so much about how to hopefully establish better habits. I have a pretty good running habit. I run the exact same route all the time, and I do it on purpose because I don't want to think when I'm run. You know, I don't want to think about turning left here or turning right there. I just want to run, get it done with, and let my brain think about other things. And many people say that's really boring. How can you run the same route over and over and over again? And I was like, well, because I don't want to think about it. And now I know that there's science involved.
Exactly. So do you listen to podcasts or the radio?
Sometimes I listen to podcasts. If I want to run slow, I'll listen to podcasts. If I want to run fast, I'll listen to music.
Yeah. See, so yeah. You're not bored.
No, not at all. Not at all. So, Wendy, what's next for you? What questions are you researching now?
I do an awful lot of research in the lab, experimental research. One of the streams of research that I'm working on right now is actually how habits relate to creativity. Because it's easy to think, well, if you're acting on habit, then you're being the opposite of creative, right?
Right.
It's sort of like what you're saying. People think that you must be bored when you're running because you're doing it in the same way each time. But back to the insight about writers and how writers use habits to spur creativity, we're finding in the lab that if people have standard ways they approach a task, it allows them to be more efficient, which maybe is no surprise, but it also allows them to be more creative. They come up with more creative ideas and solutions because they haven't wasted all that energy trying to figure out how they're going to do something. Instead, they jump in and do it. And that's where they put the emphasis. And so that's what habits can do for you, is they can allow you to move beyond the confusion. What do I do? How do I do it? How long am I going to do it for? What does end look like? And it allows you to focus on the important things.
Wonderful. Well, I think that is a really good place to end it. But before I let you go, I have a few questions that I ask everyone. I know that you're not running now, but if you could go back and talk to yourself when you first started running, what advice would you give yourself?
Take more yoga classes. I think I would have ended up doing it a bit longer if I had taken yoga more seriously. I just loved the running so much.
I don't think you're the only one that has had that answer. So my next question is, what is the greatest gift running has given you?
Oh, the sense of peace that you get, that it gives you for the rest of the day. And that's why I always liked running in the morning, is because it gives you a sense of calm that allows, I like many people, can get quite stressed at work, and it allows you to approach those challenges with a bit clearer head than I would have had otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that you used to sleep in your running clothes?
Yes.
So that's how you set up your environment to right? Remove the friction.
Yep.
That's great. And my next question, Wendy, is where can listeners connect with you?
I am on Twitter at Prof. Wendy Wood. I have a website for the book, which is goodhabitsbadhabits.org. And if people want to directly contact me, I'm a faculty member at the University of Southern California. So just Google Wendy Wood and my homepage comes up, and you can email me, wendy.wood@usc.edu. And I'm happy to answer any questions people might have.
Perfect. Well, we'll put all that information in our show notes. I really enjoyed this conversation, Wendy. I'm so glad that you could be on the show, and hopefully you've inspired some of our listeners to create better habits.
And keep running, Claire. Good for you.
I will. Our brains are fascinating, aren't they? Logically, it doesn't make much sense that simply slowing down the elevator doors a few seconds will get people to take the stairs, or driving an extra mile or two to the gym will make you less likely to go, but it's true. We often think of people who are fit and healthy as having a ton of willpower that gets them up in the morning, but willpower actually has little to do with it. It's habit that gets you up at 6 a.m. to go for a run. Okay, not the first morning, or maybe not even the 90th morning, but repetition will get you there eventually, especially if you reduce the friction that's out to stop you, even if it means sleeping in your running clothes. I loved Wendy's example of how writers set themselves up for creativity by establishing a structured routine. If you have a habit of writing every day at 9 a.m., the hard work of deciding to sit there and write eventually goes away, and you're free to be creative. Structure and routine ironically make you more free and more creative. And the same is true for your running. If you establish that you run regularly, you don't have to run the same boring route every day like I do if you don't want to. You have the freedom and the hard-earned fitness because of your regular running habit to be able to run different routes, distances, and speeds if you want to. The habit is there, so what you do with that is up to you. And that's it for the Run to the Top podcast with me, Coach Claire Bartholik, the Planted Runner. I'd like to thank all of you that have made the good habit of listening to our show every week. Have a great run today.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.